She would even have welcomed the conversation of Illyrio and her brother, but they were too far below to hear her. So she sat, in her wedding silks, nursing a cup of honeyed wine, afraid to eat, talking silently to herself. "I am Blood of the Dragon," she told herself. "I am Daenerys Stormborn, Princess of Dragonstone, of the blood and seed of Aegon the Conqueror." The sun was only a quarter of the way up in the sky when she saw her first man die. Drums were beating as some of the women danced for the Carl. Drogo watched without expression, but his eyes followed their movements, and from time to time he would toss down a bronze medallion for the women to fight over. The warriors were watching too. One of them finally stepped into the circle, grabbed a dancer by the arm, pushed her down to the ground, and mounted her, right there, as a stallion mounts a mare. Illyrio had told her this might happen. "The Dothraki mate like the animals in their herds. There is no privacy in a Khalasar, and they do not understand sin or shame as we do." Dany looked away from the coupling, frightened when she realized what was happening. But a second warrior stepped forward, and a third, and soon there was no way to avert her eyes. Then two men seized the same woman. She heard a shout, saw a shove, and in the blink of an eye, the Arryks were out, long, razor-sharp blades, half-sword and half-scythe. A dance of death began as the warriors circled and slashed, leaping toward each other, whirling the blades around their heads, shrieking insults at each clash. No one made a move to interfere. It ended as quickly as it began. The Arryks shivered together faster than Dany could follow. One man missed a step, the other swung his blade in a flat arc, steel bit into flesh, just above the Dothraki's waist, and opened him from backbone to belly button, spilling his entrails into the dust. As the loser died, the winner took hold of the nearest woman, not even the one they had been quarrelling over, and had her there and then. Slaves carried off the body, and the dancing resumed. Master Illyrio had warned Dany about this, too. "A Dothraki wedding without at least three deaths is deemed a dull affair," he had said. Her wedding must have been especially blessed. Before this day was over, a dozen men had died. As the hour passed, the terror grew in Dany, until it was all she could do not to scream. She was afraid of the Dothraki, whose ways seemed alien and monstrous, as if they were beasts in human skins and not true men at all. She was afraid of her brother, of what he might do if she failed him. Most of all, she was afraid of what would happen tonight under the stars, when her brother gave her up to the hulking giant who sat drinking beside her with a face as still and cruel as a bronze mask. "I am the Blood of the Dragon," she told herself again. When at last the sun was low in the sky, Khal Drogo clapped his hands together, and the drums and the shouting and the feasting came to a sudden halt. Drogo stood and pulled Dany to her feet beside him. It was time for her bride gifts. And after the gifts, she knew, after the sun had gone down, it would be time for the first ride and the consummation of their marriage. Dany tried to put the thought aside, but it would not leave her. She hugged herself to try to keep from shaking. Her brother Viserys gifted her with three handmaids. Dany knew they had cost him nothing. Illyria, no doubt, had provided the girls. Eri and Jiqui were copper-skinned Dothraki with black hair and almond-shaped eyes. Doria, a fair-haired, blue-eyed Lycene girl. "These are no common servants, sweet sister," her brother told her as they were brought forward one by one. "Illyrio and I select them personally for you. Eri will teach you riding, Jiqui, the Dothraki tongue, and Doria will instruct you in the womanly arts of love." He smiled thinly. "She's very good. Illyrio and I can both swear to that. Sir Jorah Mormont apologized for his gift. "It's a small thing, my princess, but all a poor exile could afford," he said as he laid a small stack of old books before her. They were histories and songs of the Seven Kingdoms, she saw, written in the common tongue. She thanked him with all her heart. Master Illyrio murmured a command, and four burly slaves hurried forward, bearing between them a great cedar chest bound in bronze. When she opened it, she found piles of the finest velvets and damasks the free cities could produce, and resting on top, nestled in the soft cloth, three huge eggs. Danny gasped. They were the most beautiful things she had ever seen, each different than the others, patterned in such rich colors that at first she thought they were crusted with jewels, and so large it took both hands to hold one. She lifted it delicately, expecting that it would be made of some fine porcelain or delicate enamel, or even blown glass, but it was much heavier than that, as if it were all of solid stone. The surface of the shell was covered with tiny scales, and as she turned the egg between her fingers, they shimmered like polished metal in the light of the setting sun. One egg was a deep green, with burnished bronze flecks that came and went depending on how Danny turned it. Another was pale cream streaked with gold. The last was black as a midnight sea, yet alive with scarlet ripples and swirls. "What are they?" she asked, her voice hushed and full of wonder. "Dragon's eggs from the shadow lands beyond Ashai," said Magister Illyrio. "The Eons have turned them to stone, yet still they burn bright with beauty." "I shall treasure them always." Danny had heard tales of such eggs, but she had never seen one, nor thought to see one. It was a truly magnificent gift, though she knew that Illyrio could afford to be lavish. He had collected a fortune in horses and slaves for his part in selling her to Khal Drogo. The Khal's blood riders offered her the traditional three weapons, and splendid weapons they were. Hago gave her a great leather whip with a silver handle, Kahalo a magnificent arrack chased in gold, and Cutho a double-curved dragon-bone bow taller than she was. Magister Illyrio and Sir Jorah had taught her the traditional refusals for these offerings. "This is a gift worthy of a great warrior, O blood of my blood, and I am but a woman. Let my lord husband bear these gifts in my stead." And so Khal Drogo, too, received his bride gifts. Other gifts she was given in plenty by other Dothraki. Slippers and jewels and silver rings for her hair, medallion belts and painted vests and soft furs, sand silks and jars of scent, needles and feathers and tiny bottles of purple glass, and a gown made from the skin of 1,000 mice. "A handsome gift, Khaleesi," Magister Illyrio said of the last, after he had told her what it was. "Most lucky." The gifts mounted up around her in great piles, more gifts than she could possibly imagine, more gifts than she could want or use. And last of all, Khal Drogo brought forth his own bride gift to her. An expectant hush rippled out from the center of the camp as he left her side, growing until it had swallowed the whole Khalasar. When he returned, the dense press of Dothraki gift-givers parted before him, and he led the horse to her. She was a young filly, spirited and splendid. Danny knew just enough about horses to know that this was no ordinary animal. There was something about her that took her breath away. She was grey as the winter sea, with a mane like silver smoke. Hesitantly, she reached out and stroked the horse's neck, ran her fingers through the silver of her mane. Khal Drogo said something in Dothraki, and Magister Illyrio translated. "Silver for the silver of your hair," the carl says. "She's beautiful," Danny murmured. "She is the pride of the Khalasar," Illyrio said. "Custom decrees that the Khaleesi must ride a mount worthy of her place by the side of the carl." Drogo stepped forward and put his hands on her waist. He lifted her up as easily as if she were a child, and set her on the thin Dothraki saddle, so much smaller than the one she was used to. Danny sat there, uncertain for a moment. No one had told her about this part. "What should I do?" she asked Illyrio. It was Sir Jorrad Mormont who answered. "Take the reins and ride. You need not go far." Nervously, Danny gathered the reins in her hands and slid her feet into the short stirrups. She was only a fair rider. She had spent far more time travelling by ship and wagon and palanquin than by horseback. Praying she would not fall off and disgrace herself, she gave the filly the lightest and most timid touch with her knees. And for the first time in hours, she forgot to be afraid. Or perhaps it was the first time ever. The silver-grey filly moved with a smooth and silken gait, and the crowd parted for her, every eye upon them. Danny found herself moving faster than she had intended, yet somehow it was exciting rather than terrifying. The horse broke into a trot, and she smiled. Dothraki scrambled to clear a path. The slightest pressure with her legs, the lightest touch on the reins, and the filly responded. She sent it into a gallop, and now the Dothraki were hooting and laughing and shouting at her as they jumped out of her way. As she turned to ride back, a fire pit loomed ahead, directly in her path. They were hemmed in on either side, with no room to stop. A daring she had never known filled Daenerys then, and she gave the filly her head. The silver horse leaped the flames as if she had wings. When she pulled up before Magister Illyrio, she said, "Tell Khal Drogo that he has given me the wind." The fat Pentoshi stroked his yellow beard as he repeated the words in Dothraki, and Danny saw her new husband smile for the first time. The last sliver of sun vanished behind the high walls of Pentos to the west just then. Danny had lost all track of time. Khal Drogo commanded his blood riders to bring forth his own horse, a lean, red stallion. As the carl was saddling the horse, Viserys slid close to Danny on her silver, dug his fingers into her leg, and said, "Please him, sweet sister, or I swear you will see the dragon wake as it has never woken before." The fear came back to her then, with her brother's words. She felt like a child once more, only 13 and all alone, not ready for what was about to happen to her. They rode out together as the stars came out, leaving the Khalasar and the grass palaces behind. Khal Drogo spoke no word to her, but drove his stallion at a hard trot through the gathering dusk. The tiny silver bells in his long braid rang softly as he rode. "I am the blood of the dragon," she whispered aloud as she followed, trying to keep her courage up. "I am the blood of the dragon. I am the blood of the dragon." The dragon was never afraid. Afterwards, she could not say how far or how long they had ridden, but it was full dark when they stopped at a grassy place beside a small stream. Drogo swung off his horse and lifted her down from hers. She felt as fragile as glass in his hands, her limbs as weak as water. She stood there helpless and trembling in her wedding silks while he secured the horses, and when he turned to look at her, she began to cry. Khal Drogo stared at her tears, his face strangely empty of expression. "No," he said. He lifted his hand and rubbed away the tears roughly with a callous thumb. "You speak the common tongue?" Danny said in wonder. "No," he said again. Perhaps he had only that word, she thought. but it was one word more than she had known he had, and somehow it made her feel a little better. Grogo touched her hair lightly, sliding the silver blonde strands between his fingers and murmuring softly in Dothraki. Danny did not understand the words, yet there was a warmth in his tone, a tenderness she had never expected from this man. He put his finger on her chin and lifted her head, so she was looking up into his eyes. Drogo towered over her as he towered over everyone. Taking her lightly under the arms, he lifted her and seated her on a rounded rock beside the stream. Then he sat on the ground facing her, legs crossed beneath him, their faces finally at a height. "No," he said. "Is that the only word you know?" she asked him. Drogo did not reply. His long, heavy braid was coiled in the dirt beside him. He pulled it over his right shoulder and began to remove the bells from his hair, one by one. After a moment, Danny leaned forward to help. When they were done, Drogo gestured. She understood. Slowly, carefully, she began to undo his braid. It took a long time. All the while, he sat there silently, watching her. When she was done, he shook his head, and his hair spread out behind him like a river of darkness, oiled and gleaming. She had never seen hair so long, so black, so thick. Then it was his turn. He began to undress her. His fingers were deft and strangely tender. He removed her silks one by one, carefully, while Danny sat unmoving, silent, looking at his eyes. When he bared her small breasts, she could not help herself. She averted her eyes and covered herself with her hands. "No," Drogo said. He pulled her hands away from her breasts gently but firmly, then lifted her face again to make her look at him. "No," he repeated. "No," she echoed back at him. He stood her up then and pulled her close to remove the last of her silks. The night air was chilly on her bare skin. She shivered, and goose flesh covered her arms and legs. She was afraid of what would come next. But for a while, nothing happened. Khal Drogo sat with his legs crossed, looking at her, drinking in her body with his eyes. After a while, he began to touch her, lightly at first, then harder. She could sense a fierce strength in his hands, but he never hurt her. He held her hand in his own and brushed her fingers one by one. He ran a hand gently down her leg. He stroked her face, tracing the curve of her ears, running a finger gently around her mouth. He put both hands in her hair and combed it with his fingers. He turned her around, massaged her shoulders, slid a knuckle down the path of her spine. It seemed as if hours passed before his hands finally went to her breasts. He stroked the soft skin underneath until it tingled. He circled her nipples with his thumbs, pinched them between thumb and forefinger, then began to pull at her, very lightly at first, then more insistently, until her nipples stiffened and began to ache. He stopped then and drew her down onto his lap. Danny was flushed and breathless, a heart fluttering in her chest. He cupped her face in his huge hands and looked into her eyes. "No," he said, and she knew it was a question. She took his hand and moved it down to the wetness between her thighs. "Yes," she whispered, as she put his finger inside her. Eddard. The summons came in the hour before the dawn, when the world was still and grey. Alan shook him roughly from his dreams, and Ned stumbled into the pre-dawn chill, groggy from sleep, to find his horse saddled and the king already mounted. Robert wore thick brown gloves and a heavy fur cloak, with a hood that covered his ears, and looked for all the world like a bear sitting on a horse. "Up, Stark," he rode. "Up, up. We have matters of state to discuss." "By all means," Ned said. "Come inside, Your Grace." Alan lifted the flap of the tent. "No, no, no," Robert said, his breath steam with every word. "The camp is full of ears. Besides, I want to ride out and taste this country of yours." Sir Boris and Sir Merrin waited behind him with a dozen guardsmen, Ned saw. There was nothing to do but rub the sleep from his eyes, dress, and mount up. Robert set the pace, driving his huge black destrier hard, as Ned galloped along beside him, trying to keep up. He called out a question as they rode, but the wind blew his words away, and the king did not hear him. After that, Ned rode in silence. They soon left the king's road, and took off across rolling plains dark with mist. By then the guard had fallen back a small distance, safely out of earshot, but still Robert would not slow. Dawn broke as they crested a low ridge, and finally the king pulled up. By then they were miles south of the main party. Robert was flushed and exhilarated as Ned reined up beside him. "Guards," he swore, laughing. "It feels good to get out and ride the way a man was meant to ride. I swear, Ned, this creeping along is enough to drive a man mad."
He had never been a patient man, Robert Baratheon. "That damnable wheelhouse, the way it creaks and groans, climbing every bump in the road as if it were a mountain. I promise you, if that wretched thing breaks another axle, I'm going to burn it, and Cersei can walk."
Ned laughed.
"I will gladly light the torch for you."
"Good man," the king clapped him on the shoulder. "I've half a mind to leave them all behind and just keep going."
A smile touched Ned's lips.
"I do believe you mean it."
"I do, I do," the king said. "What do you say, Ned? Just you and me. Two vagabond knights on the king's road. Our swords at our sides, and the gods know what in front of us, and maybe a farmer's daughter or a tavern wench to warm our beds tonight."
"Would that we could," Ned said. "But we have duties now, my liege, to the realm, to our children, I to my lady wife, and you to your queen. We are not the boys we were."
You never were the boy you were," Robert grumbled. "More's a pity. And yet, there was that one time, eh? What was her name? That common girl of yours, Becca? No, she was one of mine. God's lover, black hair and those sweet big eyes, you could drown in them. Yours was, Alina? No. You told me once, was it, Meryl? You know the one I mean, your bastard's mother."
"Her name was Willa," Ned replied with cool courtesy, "and I would sooner not speak of her."
"Willa, yes," the king grinned. "She must have been a rare wench, if she could make Lord Eddard Stark forget his honour even for an hour. You never told me what she looked like."
Ned's mouth tightened in anger. "Nor will I. Leave it be, Robert, for the love you say you bear me. I dishonoured myself, and I dishonoured Catelyn, in the sight of gods and men."
"Oh, gods have mercy, you scarcely knew Catelyn."
"I had taken her to wife. She was carrying my child."
"You're too hard on yourself, Ned. You always were. Damn it, no woman wants Baelor the Blessed in her bed."
He slapped a hand on his knee.
"Well, I'll not press you if you feel so strong about it. Though I swear at times you're so prickly you ought to take the edgehog as your sigil."
The rising sun sent fingers of light through the pale white mists of dawn. A wide plain spread out beneath them, bare and brown, its flatness here and there relieved by long, low hummocks. Ned pointed them out to the king, the barrows of the first men.
Robert frowned.
"Have we ridden on to a graveyard?"
"There are barrows everywhere in the north, Your Grace," Ned told him. "This land is old."
"And cold," Robert grumbled, pulling his cloak more tightly around himself.
The guard had reined up well behind them at the bottom of the ridge.
Well, I did not bring you out here to talk of graves or bicker about your bastard. There was a rider in the night from Lord Varys in King's Landing. Here. The king pulled a paper from his belt and handed it to Ned. Varys, the eunuch, was the king's master of whisperers. He served Robert now, as he had once served Aerys Targaryen. Ned unrolled the paper with trepidation, thinking of Lysa and her terrible accusation. But the message did not concern Lady Aerys.